Wood Mackenzie's Energy and Natural Resources Summit for the Asia-Pacific region is coming soon. Join industry leaders and our expert analysts for discussions and presentations on everything to do with the energy transition in Asia, covering power, renewable energy, critical minerals, LNG, upstream, and more. Topics covered will include trends in solar, wind, and battery markets and supply chains, the emergence of low-carbon commodity markets, and investment in critical minerals. It's taking place on May the 9th at the Marina Bay Sands Hotel in Singapore. Visit woodmac.com/events/energy-summit-APAC to secure your ticket. That's woodmac.com/events/energy-summit-APAC. We hope to see you there. Hello and welcome to The Energy Gang, a discussion show about the fast-moving world of energy. I'm Ed Crooks, and I'm joined today by Melissa Lott, who's a professor at the Climate School at Columbia University in New York. Hi, Melissa. How are you?
I'm good, Ed. I just got to Austin, Texas from New York. So, you know, going between my two energy homes. I was stuck on the tarmac last night, though, because they had some big storms. I don't know how much they affected all the flights, but we had a bunch of diverted flights from Houston and other places. It was a busy place at 2 a.m. I'll just say that. So there you go. But it's good to see you.
Indeed. Very good to see you. Thanks very much for joining us. Very glad you're able to make it. And it's also a great pleasure to welcome back, also from Texas, Michael Weber. Michael is the John J. Maquetta Centennial Energy Chair in the Department of Mechanical Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin. And he's also Chief Technology Officer at Energy Impact Partners, which is a $3 billion clean tech venture fund. Hi, Michael. How are you? Great to have you back.
Good. It's good to be in conversation with you again. I feel like energy is a hot topic, as it always is.
Indeed. And great to be talking about it now. So look, it is a hot topic, and the hottest topic within energy is the first thing I want to start on today. It worries me a bit because I feel like we're sounding a bit like a stuck record on this one. But I want to talk again about AI and data centers and growing demand for energy. I think it is worth coming back to it because it is, as I say, the hottest topic in energy right now. Everyone is talking about it. And also this week, we've had some genuinely very significant developments, I think, that we should get into. You may have heard on our last show, we were talking about exactly this topic with Amy Myers Jaffe and Samantha Gross. We had a great discussion about the problems that rising electricity demand is creating for decarbonisation goals. And what we've had this week is we've had some companies saying, we're going to do something about that. And we had this announcement from Google and Microsoft and Nucor, the steel company. And what they're saying is they're getting together to support the development of new low-carbon, zero-carbon energy technologies. And they say they're going to support first-of-a-kind and early commercial projects in advanced low-carbon energy. Four technologies they mentioned specifically are advanced nuclear, enhanced geothermal, low-carbon hydrogen, and long-duration energy storage, although they say they could also go beyond that as well. And the idea is that by joining forces, using their buying power, financial muscle together, they can help bring these new low-carbon technologies to scale faster than if things were done in a kind of piecemeal way, just as individual companies supporting these particular technologies. And it also takes some of the risk out of it if there are larger companies all supporting a project together. So you could say they are using their buying power to buy power, if you like. Do you like that one?
That's a good one, Ed. That's a good one. I like that.
It is. Yeah.
Well done.
You get permission for that one. That's good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Good may be a strong word for it. But anyway, as I say, I think the concept of using their buying power in that way is really interesting, very significant development. So that's why I wanted to get into that first today. So, Melissa, start with you on this one, because I know you've been looking into this. You've been talking to them about it and thinking about what they're doing. What do you make of this announcement?
Yeah, so starting with like the fundamentals, I mean, this is really additional push from Google around how do we get firm dispatchable power into the system? How do we actually get more power generation into the system? And how do we get these technologies that we want to see advancing that seem incredibly useful if we want to keep the price of electricity low, reliability high, and also electricity increasing clean over time? We need to get these technologies into the system. So I was talking to Michelle Chang over at Google just yesterday. She was at a busy meeting. We both kind of like ducked into corners for a quick phone call. And we're just chatting through, you know, what this means. And I'll say for my part of the conversation, what Google is doing, along with Microsoft and Nucor, is, again, they're aggregating demand. They're creating that demand pull we talk about in the system. You can have all the supply push you want, but if supply doesn't have anywhere to go, you know, if it doesn't have that pull and it doesn't have that market demand, you're going to have issues. You're going to go slower than you want to. But they're specifically, it seems like, trying to figure out one of those, what is the phrase, sticky wickets, those things you just can't quite work through, around how do we contract these technologies? How do we actually get them onto the system? How do we create these offtake agreements? How do we get an advanced technology that is ready for commercialization, is ready to go? Because that seems to be what they're emphasizing, is not early, early, early stage technologies, but the ones that are ready to go and ready to scale up quickly and get them onto the system. In some ways, I'm thinking back, Michael, to when I was a graduate student at UT Austin, and we talked about the Texas grid being a great laboratory for, you know, figuring some stuff out. A lot of this seems like that to me. They're saying, hey, we have to scale this stuff up. We're going to create the demand for it. We're going to tell you have the demand, and we're going to work through contracts, and we're going to work through the whole process of getting these technologies online. Because if we don't, first principles, if we don't have firm power plants, we will have higher prices of electricity if our goal is to go to net zero electricity, if it's to get as clean as possible, because wind, solar, and storage just aren't enough to keep prices low and reliability high.
Right. So that's very interesting. So you're saying that it's not just about the technological innovation in terms of the hardware and the science and how you actually get these technologies to work. It's also about business model innovation, if you like, and legal innovation and contractual innovation, all those other things that go around the technology to actually make it commercially viable.
Yeah. So, I mean, we had to figure out a lot of stuff when we started bringing new wind farms online, you know, when it was like, all right, we're not just doing a couple little ones here and there. We're actually going to do this at scale. How do we do that? How do we standardize those contracts? How do we think about power purchase agreements? How do we think about, well, in that case, RECs and a bunch of other things. But when you're talking about, okay, we want to actually build out an advanced nuclear plant or an enhanced geothermal plant, you know, what is the agreement that we need to put together? How do we de-risk that agreement? How do we make it work for a commercial partner who's going to be buying it? You know, who gets paid where, what, when? There's just a lot of things that I feel like we're going to figure out as these first agreements are written, because these are first for a lot of these technologies.
Right. And one of the interesting analogies that I've heard people talk about is a parallel with the pharmaceutical industry. These things, advanced market commitments, where to support the development of a new drug, you have governments or other buyers who will say, if you can get this technological breakthrough, if you can find a solution, a vaccine or a treatment that works for this particular condition we're aiming to address, then we promise we will buy a certain amount of it. And the idea then is that it gives companies the confidence to invest in R&D to develop these new vaccines and treatments, because they know they're not going to kind of have this great scientific breakthrough, which turns out then not to be a commercial breakthrough because nobody wants to buy it. You know, as I say, they have that confidence that the market is there if the product is there. Do you think that's a good analogy? Is this a similar kind of thing that's going on here?
Yeah, I think it's creating a demand signal. It's saying, Kevin Costner, you build it, we will come. We will come play the game. So I think of it in parallel with two other actions in the energy sector that we've talked about sort of recently. One, there's a podcast episode we did for The Big Switch called Clean Heat for All. And it was saying, hey, if you can create a heat pump system for apartments that can work in social housing projects, New York will buy thousands and thousands of them. So make it work and it will happen. And they did. The technology got there. But then there's also many, many parallels we can think about in terms of, I need this thing. I'm thinking about Kickstarter campaigns, which is not an energy parallel. Hey, if we can get this much money, we're going to create the next episode of this movie. We're going to create the next one in what will become a trilogy, maybe. And if we get even more money, we'll go even further and build out all these things. So what these companies are doing is they're saying the demand's there. If you can supply what we need, we will pay you for it. So we're giving you a market. We are creating a market. And by aggregating our demand, we're creating a bigger market than we would otherwise, so it can make sense for more technologies at more scales. And I think that having big companies come together like this, it's a starting point. There's a paper that I was involved in. It was, lead author was a couple of students I worked with. It was about corporate procurement of renewables. And it talked about the power of aggregating demand, in particular around companies that had smaller demand than maybe a large company with a lot of data centers will have. And so this is a first step where a bunch of companies with a bunch of electricity demand that looks to be increasing over time are trying to find the solutions they need and creating the market that's not already being created by sending a demand signal. And after this process, there'll be a lot of learning, and more companies can participate and can engage, because the road will be, I don't want to say paved, but it will at least be graded and smoothed for people to go down. It won't be kind of a rocky, you know, bumpy road through the forest.
Yeah, at least some of the undergrowth will have been cleared away and you may be able to see where you're meant to be going. Yeah, indeed. Yeah, so Michael, what do you think about this? How significant a development is this?
I think it's an important development. I guess there are a couple things I think about when it comes to data centers, and that is before all the recent news the last few years around artificial intelligence and everything else, data centers were already growing quickly. The demand for data was growing, and therefore the demand for power for the data centers was growing. So the fundamental trend was already on a pretty significant upswing. And the data centers already been having trouble just getting power. When they come into a utility area and they want to build a data center, these data centers can be anywhere from like 100 megawatts to 600 megawatts. So they're pretty substantial in size. Utilities are saying, sounds great. We'd be happy to have you. We'll give you your hookup in 2028 or something like that. And there's too much money to be made in the intervening 4 or 5 years. So this is a real problem for the data centers, just getting access to power. And now you're adding in this additional layer that they really want 24/7 clean firm power for a variety of business reliability and customer reasons. And so that was the fundamental situation already. Then you add in artificial intelligence, which compounds all those problems, even more growth in data, even more demand for power, even more risks of delays in getting the power they need. And that is problematic. And I think this sort of the cost of the delays, the cost of inaccessible power, meaning they just can't get access to power at any price. And then also costs around reliability or variability of power are going to be complicated. So you're seeing a lot of push from data center companies, which are Amazon and Google and Facebook or Meta and Microsoft. They're really trying to solve this. And it partly is a solution of we just need more supply, build more stuff more quickly. It also needs to be the type of supply that isn't variable because data centers, for the most part, aren't considered variable or dispatchable load. There are some data centers that can be because they just have streaming on Netflix or Hulu or something. A lot of data centers have critical data and don't want to be turned on and off. They're really on and stay on. Also, they make a lot of money with a kilowatt hour electricity. They'd rather stay on because it's a moneymaker. And so adding in the growing demand for artificial intelligence, which and the numbers are astronomical, we'll see how it shapes up, but a lot of new power needed just for the artificial intelligence components of it can change things. However, the artificial intelligence has kind of two phases. There's the training and then the use. The training is very energy intensive. But maybe could be flexible. We're actually starting to look at that at the University of Texas. What if you can dispatch the training, but the use of it maybe is not dispatchable, like meaning whenever you want to use it, you want to use it, you don't have to wait. But there might be some training period that's ever. So we're trying to figure that out and what that means for the data centers. But this sets the key, like there was already a problem and now it's about to get worse with artificial intelligence. So what do you do? Well, the big buyers say, let's aggregate our demand. In some ways, that's not a new concept that the original utilities 100 years ago were aggregated supply or aggregated demand. The Department of Defense has used its purchasing power for decades to get access to special energy features and performance characteristics. So some of this looks entirely in keeping with everything we've seen for the last few years, but it's not typical you see competitors coming together to aggregate for new technologies.
Indeed. Just jumping back to something you were saying there about AI and AI power demand, you drew that distinction between training the AI models and using them. Do you have a sense of how power demand is going to break down between those two use cases? As you say, because that training can be dispatchable, can be turned off at times, that's fine. The use really can't be.
We think it can be dispatchable. So we're just starting a research initiative now with some other people around the nation whose names you might recognize. So it's all early. We don't have any really results, but we're just starting the conversation because as energy modelers, we're not artificial intelligence people. We're just energy modelers, but we're trying to figure out how AI would be used. And my understanding is that the training takes a long time. It could take months to train certain types of questions or models and platforms, this kind of thing. And that is dispatchable. That doesn't mean companies will want it to be turned on and off. They might be in a hurry to get their training done. And then the use will be much less energy intensive, much less time intensive, and much less dispatchable. And so you should expect much more energy use at the training than the use phase. However, the training phase might be weeks or months. The use phase might go on for years or decades. So in total, use will probably be higher than the training. But in terms of like how much energy you need per day or whatever, the power demands might be a little bit different. But we're trying to figure that out. And I don't really understand. And it's such a moving target. I'm not even sure the AI world has a full grasp on what is super urgent, what is flexible, what can we wait on, that kind of thing. And we're trying to sort that out. I will make one more observation based on things I'm hearing from people in the data center world is if you talk to the big American data center companies, the ones I mentioned earlier, they think there's a national security element to this, which is if we don't do it, China will. And it's sort of United States versus China on this, because I think a lot of the other countries that have the computer scientists or people who can do AI don't have all the data centers or all the power to run the data centers. And so there's this push, like, we need to get more power so we can get data centers so we can do artificial intelligence, because we need to be ahead on this, because if we're not, China will get ahead of it and they will use it perhaps for nefarious or malevolent purposes. And so there's this urgency or this sense of high stakes element to this, that we need to build more capacity to protect our national security, not because it lets us run our weapon systems or this kind of thing, but because it helps protect ourselves from very sophisticated disinformation campaigns or other things you can do with AI.
Indeed, which raises the interesting point also about a lot of these technologies, which is price is much less of a factor than it would be if you're just selling electricity to regular consumers, right? You know, if you think about sort of small modular nuclear, when that project that a lot of people were pinning their hopes on, NuScale 1 in Idaho Falls, when that got scrapped last year, the big issue was that the utilities that were meant to be the customers for it, were going to be selling power then to their customers, didn't want to bear that cost. They thought it was too expensive, and they thought that natural gas and renewables would be significantly cheaper. If you're talking about, as you say, sort of national security imperatives and these sort of business critical data centers and so on, you're probably prepared to pay a bit more of a premium to make sure that that power is always there.
Yes and no, but I would say, I think you're basically correct. So if we stack and sort the customers by the value they would put on electricity or their price they're willing to pay, residential consumers, we pay 10 cents or 12 cents a kilowatt hour, whatever it is, depending on where you are in the United States, say, and that electricity is very important and valuable to us for our comfort, and maybe in certain conditions is life or death, but it's not something we want to pay a dollar per kilowatt hour for in general. We're pretty price sensitive. Most companies can't pay too much for electricity because it's a big part of their overall bill, if it's a retail outlet or a restaurant or hotel or whatever it is. At the highest end of the spectrum, to my knowledge, there might be others, or like semiconductor chip fabs, these factories that make semiconductors, they make a lot of money with these kilowatt hours. So they pay 10 cents, and I don't know how many hundreds of dollars they're making per kilowatt hour, but they make a lot of money. And they are price sensitive because electricity is important input, but they make a lot of money with that electricity, so they're more reliability sensitive. And I think data centers are somewhere in between, where it is their biggest bill. They got to pay for the data center and the operation. Electricity is a huge part of the bill, so they are price sensitive, but they are also very reliability sensitive, because the downtime when that chip fab turns off or that data center turns off, there's so much money they're leaving behind. They would rather pay more for a more reliable system. And you could argue also a more reliable system ends up being cheaper anyway for a variety of reasons. So they've kind of done the math on that. But then you add in addition to the reliability requirements, a requirement from their customers or their internal requirements from their employees or their shareholders to have clean power. They might pay a little bit more for clean power if it comes with reliability. So they're solving for a multi-parameter optimization problem, and price is a big part. They are price sensitive. They talk about that all the time, but I think they really want reliability. And maybe the military is different, where they want reliability or performance features for the warfighter more than price, but energy price is a pretty big bill for them too. They would like to get something cheaper if they could.
And I'll make one comment on the reliability. So it's what you said, Michael, right there, which is they make a lot of money for being up for those periods of time, you know, off those kilowatt hours they use. But also, if they do have to go down, and we saw this during Winter Storm Uri, if they do have to go down, it's not a matter of, oh, this hour I got to go down and I'll come back up within an hour, you know, after. It's like I'm having memories right now of working in a clean room at Sandia National Labs back in my early 20s. And if you took that system down, it took you days to get it back up and to get it to the standards it needed to be to actually continue the fabrication processes we were doing. And so, you know, this isn't a matter of a blip. These are big impacts if things go down, if you do have a reliability issue.
Huge problem, and a lot of lost money and a lot of lag time and shutting down the system and then cleaning the room back up before the clean room's safe for the chips and for the optics and everything else. But the other thing that happens with Winter Storm Uri or these other storms, if you have a spike or some shutoff and blows up equipment, because you get these surges to the system, so they've got damages they got to deal with. It's a big issue. I think the data centers are less likely to have blown up equipment, but this is a big issue. You got to ramp back up, and then you got to get your system back to equilibrium. There are some dispatchable loads that are much easier. To my mind, I'm thinking like water treatment. If you don't have power for an hour or two, they've got 24 hours of treated water stored in site. Water is very easy to store. You put it in a big tank. So there are some operations that can take sort of flexibility into mind more easily than AI and data centers. Although I have this question in my mind, the training phase of AI might be flexible. Can we tease that out a little bit? And that's what we're trying to do with some of our research. So hopefully I'll have an answer for you in some number of months.
And around this, just to take it to its next step, if we are looking at, as we move to more clean energy and we are thinking about greenhouse gas emissions, but air pollution, water use, et cetera, and we're depending on electricity for more things, these sensitivities become bigger deals, not just in our businesses, but also in our homes, so across the entire economy. So back to another aspect of the security discussion is how are we making sure we're building out the system, not just an individual power plant, but the system we need in the future. And all the analysis I'm reading, please tell me if y'all are seeing something different, but it just says we need firm power to complement the other types of, you know, members of the team that are getting us clean power. So this is a critical step in it. And we need to start moving those electrons now. We need to start getting them on the grid now.
I think there are several pieces. I think, yeah, we need a systems approach for sure, because just building a power plant here or there is not going to get us all the way there. So we have to think about the supply. We have to think about the wires and poles, building a bigger system, especially a system that's bigger than the weather. These storms can be quite large, but they're never quite as large as the entire continent, say. So we need larger scale transmission and connectivity. We need larger scale storage, and we need dispatchable load. And if we have all those things, we'll probably get to where we need to be. But in Texas and many other places, we obsess on the supply side. Well, let's build more power plants, and we leave out the wires and poles, the storage, or the demand side. And so that's like trying to use a hammer to solve every mechanical problem and leaving out wrenches and screwdrivers and sockets and other things that you might need. So I'd say let's use every tool in the toolbox instead of just one.
So in that context, I'm interested to hear what both of you think then about the specific technologies that this group, Google, Microsoft, and Nucor, are talking about. So as I say, they say they weren't limiting themselves to these four technologies, but the four they mentioned were advanced nuclear, enhanced geothermal, clean hydrogen, and long-duration energy storage. Are those the right four, do you think? And what are the various kind of pros and cons of those four if you were kind of trying to choose between them?
So those are the four I would start with, but there are more. And those are good ones for a variety of reasons. Nuclear, if it's small modular reactors, it's air-cooled. You can site almost anywhere. Geothermal is available around the world, just a matter of how deep you got to drill, though there's some sites, say Nevada or Iceland, where the geothermal energy is closer to the surface. Storage, long-duration storage especially, is useful anywhere and everywhere, so we just need more of it for everybody. And then hydrogen, if you can make it cheap and clean, it would be pretty handy as a way to store the energy or to generate it on demand. So that's all exciting. That's the list I would probably start with. A lot of places also would add hydro. So if you're in Canada or Norway or a place with abundant hydro, that is clean, firm, cheap. It's a lower impact if you do it the right way than a lot of things. But in places like California, hydro is now considered a variable source of power, not baseload, because the weather patterns are so significant and the droughts are significant that the water is maybe not available as reliably as before. But in some places, hydro, you maybe add to the list. If you're in the northwest coast of France or maybe in Newfoundland or places with great tidal separation, you could use tidal energy, but that's very geographically limited. There are tidal basins in Wales and China where they're building tidal power. That's kind of dispatchable. We know the tides with great precision, looking out a couple thousand years, so you can plan for it, and it has built-in storage. You could also use biomass as a dispatchable power plant, but it has other problems associated with it around deforestation or air quality and cost or other handling. And then there's also things like salinity gradients. If you have a freshwater river hit the ocean, these salinity gradients can be used for 24/7 clean dispatchable power. And there's a startup actually developing some pilots in France right now. So there are other technologies, but they're either geographically limited in a way that maybe hydrogen and storage and nuclear aren't. Geothermal, you might say, is kind of geographically limited, depends on your view. Or they are too expensive, or they have other concerns you're worried about. But so that means I agree with that list of four. That's probably where I would start.
Yeah, and I mean, it looks like they threaded the needle in the sense of we're encouraging newer technologies to come into the system, but these are not technologies that are still on the lab bench. These are not technologies that are, you know, decades away from being able to be dispatched at scale. These are technologies that, yes, are a little bit, you know, lower number on the TRL, the technology readiness level scale, but they're right at the cusp of being ready to be commercialized at scale. And so when you look at what this could spur, it's not, I assume very intentionally, it's not focused on a technology that with this demand signal in 20 to 30 years could be deploying. These are things that could actually have impact, not tomorrow, this will take time, but in this next decade, you would see these technologies coming online potentially at large scale.
One sort of vagueness on this, I haven't read all the press release, so I can't remember exactly what they said for the aggregated demand, is the role of nuclear. I usually assume if it's a data center talking nuclear, they're talking about fission, not fusion. And they're talking about small modular reactors, not large non-modular reactors. And that tends to be where a lot of the action is. But there is this deal that was signed in May 2023 between Microsoft and a fusion company, Helion, with promises to deliver, I can't remember, is it 2028 or something, like just a few years. And I believe that's a different kind of signal. So that's a little bit different than what Melissa said. Like, that strikes me as a low TRL, low technology readiness level thing, fusion. but the fusion company says they're ready to go in just a couple of years. So there might be some open-mindedness even within the nuclear category for the data centers. I think in the end, if you can make it and it's clean and firm, they'll buy it.
Yeah, and I think they said advanced nuclear. That was the phrase they used. So, I mean, within this...
That's vague. Advanced nuclear leaves open all these options.
Yeah, and I guess this is my interpretation of what they were saying. And it seems to track is just they're looking not for... Yes, innovation long-term is important, but how am I getting the electrons I need in the near term? And so advanced nuclear, they're not so specific, but they're like, this type of small modular reactor design with these types of bubble, da-da-da. It's open beyond that, but it is signaling we have interest in this category of technologies. And I think it is interesting that they didn't flag hydro. To me, that's a sign of they are looking to push these technologies that aren't quite on the system onto the system. Where with hydro, I mean, it's great, don't get me wrong, but it's something we know how to do.
It's great 1880s technology.
We know how to, you know, make things more efficient, recover more energy, all that, but it's technology, we know how it works.
Going back to the fusion, Michael, did you say 2028 or 2038?
2028. Right. So I'm looking at the press release and I just pulled up while you were talking, Melissa. So it was May 23, the deal was signed, and to deliver 50 megawatts in 5 years. All right, so it's not a gigawatt, but 50 megawatts is a small data center. That's pretty interesting.
I'm going to call it right now. This is an open offer to you and indeed to anyone listening to the Energy Gang. I will take anyone's bet at any price on no one actually paying real money for real power from a fusion plant in 2028. That seems absolutely wildly implausible to me.
I don't think I'm going to take that bet. However, I can't remember the details. I believe that there are performance penalties in the contract, if I remember correctly.
Wow.
Where if the fusion company doesn't deliver. So it's not, yeah. There are a lot of these PPAs where some say, hey, will you buy this power if we can make it? They're like, sure, okay, we'll buy it if you can make it. But this one, I think there's a promise to deliver and penalties if they don't. So this is a firmer commitment. Now, I think it's a 50 megawatt pilot, so maybe they won't actually be a transaction that year, but they'll turn it on and then we'll see. But generally with nuclear, it's better to bet on later rather than earlier. And I say that as a nuclear fan, but I think these timelines can slip pretty easily.
I do want to just flag one more thing before we transition to another part of the conversation around this, which is back to these are big companies aggregating their demand. They're within this, and they signaled this in the press release, but this is also a hedge against risk for them. You know, so it's not just Google putting themselves kind of out there and saying, you know, we're going to guarantee that we're going to take these electrons if you can get any one of these kind of early-ish stage technologies onto the system and electrons from them. And so I think that's just another important signal as well, because they are having a hedge risk on the demand side as they procure this electricity. They are pushing the envelope a little bit. They're not going with kind of tried and true steady. We definitely know that we can operate this technology. They are pushing the envelope a bit.
One question I have, as you say, we should move on, but final thought from me on this is, should there be more companies involved? Is three enough, even these very large companies on the scale of Microsoft and Google? And if you look, as you were saying, Michael, earlier, you know, this is not a super new idea. We've seen examples of this type of model many times in the past. If you think about something like the Clean Energy Buyers Association, do you know those people who are, again, a group of companies getting together to support procurement of essentially wind and solar power? And that's actually been very, very effective in building up wind and solar power investment in the US in particular, and also other parts of the world. And that's got something like more than 400 members, including, I think, probably Microsoft, Google, and Nucor, but a whole load more besides. Is this really an effort that we should get more energy buyers jumping in on if we really want to see real movement in some of these new frontier technologies?
I think if you look at the other alliances, it was usually large retail, things like Walmart, big stores and companies are saying, hey, we need more power and our customers would like it to be clean. We have big rooftops where you could put solar, this kind of thing. So that really helped move the market along. But there was, you said, I think hundreds of members of these buyers alike, because there's many big box stores and national chains and restaurants and hotels, this kind of thing. But in the data center world has fewer participants because of the expertise and capital and other things required. And so it's a different kind of buyer's alliance. And I am not a lawyer. I've got no idea what antitrust law is, but I wonder, like, will this be a concern for people, or will lawyers and regulators think, oh no, this is good because this actually will have consumer benefit either for the cost of the data or lowering the cost of power overall. So I think it's a little bit different in terms of like just the number of participants, also the style of participants, and just the demand. So I think a Walmart store needs a couple megawatts of power. And it's very important that they keep the power, because the power goes out, they have to throw away a couple $100,000 of food and this kind of thing. So they're an important buyer, but a data center is going to be hundreds of megawatts. It's a very different kind of hot spot of demand. And there are fewer companies participating. So that might change the shape of this a little bit. I do think it's entirely reasonable, though, for buyers to push the utilities, especially utility regulators. So the Clean Energy Buyers Alliance was push utilities to give us cleaner options. We want them. That makes it easier for those utilities to go to the regulators and say, we'd like to build clean options. And so I think this is a useful push that makes the regulatory process a little smoother if you're in one of those regulated markets.
This is a starting point, not an ending point. If the end point eventually is 100% zero carbon grid, the question is, so right now, when it comes to getting firm dispatchable power, especially from these technologies online, but in general, it's an uphill battle. You're kind of pushing uphill, and these companies are saying, we're going to push uphill altogether. And then over time, you can imagine as they prove out the different concepts of how you do it, more and more companies, and we see this in the past, will join. And my question is, when will it then be, you know, on the other side of the hill and you're going downslope and the momentum is just absolutely unavoidable? But this is not a small deal. These are big companies with real needs, and there is a risk to them if they don't dive into this. There's a risk to them by diving into this. They're going to do it anyway, and they're going to do it together and hedge against that and hopefully show us pathways again for how you can get these technologies in the system. Because if we don't, we're going to have issues with affordability, reliability, or both.
Indeed. Yeah. So let's move on then and dig into one of the specific technologies that this new buyers group has been talking about, which is clean hydrogen. Of course, something we've talked about a lot on the show, ways to make low carbon hydrogen, two crucial routes, what they generally call green hydrogen, made from electrolyzing water using a zero carbon renewable energy power source, or you can use natural gas, break that down, take the carbon dioxide emissions and capture and store them. But there's another type of hydrogen that's now attracting a lot of interest, and that is natural hydrogen trapped in rocks under the earth, sometimes referred to as gold or white hydrogen. As you know, every type of hydrogen has to have a color attached to it. I think often those colors don't really help with understanding, so let's call it natural hydrogen for the purposes of this discussion. And as I say, hydrogen's in the rock, and you get it out essentially the same way that you get out oil or gas, by drilling for it. And it's very much a sort of emerging area of knowledge in terms of what's out there, how much hydrogen the world has. It's not something that really people have thought about very much before. The geology and the geophysics and the chemistry are not super well understood, but it does seem there is an enormous amount of hydrogen there. And the estimate from the US Geological Survey is there could be 5 trillion tons of natural hydrogen in rocks around the world. Given that, if you think about how much hydrogen the world might realistically need, if you think about, for instance, our net zero scenario, Wood Mackenzie, that's kind of a model we have done of what the world could look like on a pathway to net zero emissions by 2050. So that's meeting the goals of the Paris Agreement and so on. In that world, you need 500 million tons of low carbon hydrogen every year. So 5 trillion is a vast amount. Even if you could only get out a fraction of that, that could still absolutely meet the world's entire need for low carbon hydrogen in a zero emissions world. So it's potentially very, very significant. And the advocates of it say it could be both cheaper and cleaner than producing low carbon hydrogen using those methods I've talked about, using water, using natural gas. So it does seem quite exciting. But Michael, what do you think? Are you excited about this promise of natural hydrogen?
I'm very excited, very enthusiastic about it. And I do agree with you, we should call it natural hydrogen or geologic hydrogen and not white or clear or gold hydrogen. I think the colors are confusing and rife for misinterpretation. So natural hydrogen is usually what I refer to it as. And I think it's pretty exciting. Backing up a little bit, there are many ways to make hydrogen. I think that's an important foundational element of this. Electrolysis of water with clean electricity or steam methane reforming of methane with or without carbon capture are sort of the ways that people make it today or think about making it in the near future. And those are pathways that are proved and make sense for a variety of legacy asset reasons with steam methane reforming or because of clean energy reasons for electrolysis. But there's also pyrolysis and photobiological approaches and photoelectric approaches. There are many ways to make hydrogen. One of them is through these redox reactions, these reduction oxidation reactions with iron-rich or magnesium-rich rocks. And those rocks exist in abundance in the subsurface, which is really amazing. And we've known for a long time with the history of hydrogen that if you put iron and sulfuric acid, for example, you get hydrogen bubbling out. So we know there are ways to make hydrogen. And it turns out the earth does this for you in many places. And I think that gives a great opportunity to go find it, let the earth do the heavy lifting and get it more cheaply and more abundantly than what you could do out of water. So I think that's pretty interesting. There's a lot of private money going into this space and there's a lot of exploration. And frankly, if you read the literature, we've been stumbling into the hydrogen for over 100 years.
Stumbling into it in what sense? You mean because people just come across natural seeps and things? And
yeah, you did natural seeps, or you drill for oil and gas, you find some hydrogen, like, oh man, usually there is a bummer, like, oh, we found hydrogen, let's shut down the wells, move on. But now, like, what if you look for the hydrogen? Reminds you of geothermal, where you drill for oil and gas and you find heat. And that was, you know, sometimes a bummer. What if you aimed for the heat?
Yeah, that is interesting. What do you think about the technical issues involved, though? As people often say, hydrogen, in a lot of ways, is a more challenging gas to produce than methane, natural gas. It's got various issues around the way it reacts with metals, the fact that it can escape through small cracks more easily, the molecules are smaller, the fact that it combusts at a much broader range of mixes with air and so on than natural gas does. The hazards do seem significantly greater, don't they?
Yeah, for sure. It is a very exciting molecule in that it likes to react. That's the good news. It gives us a lot of energy if we burn it, or it gives us a lot of chemicals if we react it on purpose. The bad news is it will also react with the metal in the pipes and lead to embrittlement if we're not careful. It likes to escape because it has a small molecular cross-section, and so it can sneak through the seals or the O-rings or the flanges or whatever the parts are in your system. So we have to worry about the reactivity and the escapability, so to speak, of hydrogen. And that's true no matter how you make it, whether you extract it from natural reservoirs or you're making it through electrolysis or steam methane reforming. The handling issues remain the same. For the natural hydrogen situation, there is a lot of it. It's very exciting. There's also a lot of oil and gas. That doesn't mean all the oil and gas is accessible. The same kind of thing is the situation with hydrogen. Okay, just because it's there doesn't mean it's easy to get. We still have to get it to the surface. Then we have to separate it. Are we going to lift it with water or foam? Or what are we going to do to get the hydrogen to the surface? How do we separate it, handle it? And then do we move it to market, or do we use it on site to make chemicals or power or something like that? So you have all sorts of challenges that still to be sorted out. But it's pretty exciting, fundamentally, that there's a larger resource there in the first place, because that opens up this possibility that maybe we don't have to torture water and torture methane to get the hydrogen out. The earth will have done that hard work for us, which is, in the end, what we did with wood and coal and oil and gas. Like, we can make oil, we can make methane, but it's easier if the world does it for you, because lifting costs for extraction are a whole lot cheaper and easier than the manufacturing costs of converting the different molecules from one to another.
Yeah, that is a great point. Melissa, what do you think? Are you excited by natural hydrogen?
I find it really, really interesting, because back to how we get to net zero across entire energy systems, how we make sure it's affordable, reliable, and clean, hydrogen's a really cool tool to have in your toolbox. Have you guys ever worked through Michael Liebreich's hydrogen ladder?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I happened to be revisiting it here this week. Just was looking through it, kind of reflecting, as one does when one is an energy nerd, on the role in high temperature and low temperature industrial applications of hydrogen. But backing up to this question, what I am thinking through is, okay, so you've got a lower cost resource that is location constrained now, right? So it is where it is. It's produced where it's produced. Man, what's the first word that goes off in my brain? Geopolitics. Who's going to have it? Who has the resource? Who doesn't? So in the United States, we have super benefited from just having a ton of resource in the ground. Now we decide to dig some of it out, not other stuff. But the point is, we have these resources, and that puts us in a very different position in the world because of that. So who has, Michael, I think, what is it? They're called fairy circles. Who has these places with hydrogen?
Yeah, that is a visual surface indicator of sometimes there's a seep of hydrogen that kills the vegetation. You get these fairy circles, but it also happens in places where there aren't fairy circles, but fairy circles are an interesting clue for some of them.
So here's a question, though. It's, you either have the setup of natural things that has produced these reservoirs effectively of hydrogen, or you don't. I find this very interesting how that's all going to play out, because there's a lot of countries that want to be players in the hydrogen world. And they're like, look, I have, you know, water and electricity, or I've got natural gas and carbon capture, and, you know, I can produce this in different ways. And how will that balance all kind of work its way out? I think it's interesting, and it definitely throws a wrench into the works of conversations that have purely been focused on hydrogen as something you can produce wherever you have those key ingredients and are willing to make an investment.
And I think that geographic separation from the oil and gas is fascinating. So just to take that a little further, the conditions that are appropriate for generating large volumes of natural hydrogen are in different locations than where the oil and gas is. So in the United States, we have a lot of natural hydrogen, but it's not in West Texas. North Africa has a lot of natural hydrogen, but it's in Morocco, not where the gas is in Algeria or the oil is in Libya. In the Middle East, it's in Oman, not Qatar or the United Arab Emirates, right? So these are different locations. And so you might have different sets of winners and losers. Now, the United States is big enough, we'll still have winners within it, but it will be the Midwest or whatever instead of Texas. And that has different flow of money, which can be quite good. That means more money for people who maybe didn't have the money from oil and gas. And that's perhaps good news, but bad news for the losers, but also raises this question Melissa's talking about. Like, okay, we got to move it to markets. Do we build pipelines? Are we going to truck it or upgrade the hydrogen to something that's worth more? The only winner all the way around, probably like Australia. I feel like Australia has everything. So they have oil and gas and wind and solar and coal and uranium and natural hydrogen. So that's what happens when you have an entire continent to yourself, I guess.
I do think the other thing that's very interesting about this in sort of energy transition terms, again, is it could be a way to redeploy skills and expertise and technology from the oil and gas industry towards low carbon energy. And I thought it was very interesting. One of the reasons people are talking about natural hydrogen right now is because the US Geological Survey and the Colorado School of Mines recently announced they're setting up a new program to explore the potential of geological hydrogen. And if you look at who's involved in that, some very big names from the oil and gas industry. BP is there, Chevron, Petrobras. And certainly it does look, as I say, like one way to kind of redeploy those skills. And again, given the spectacular achievements that have been made by the oil and gas industry in the US in particular, in terms of the shale gas revolution, the tight oil revolution, how that picture was completely turned around over the past 20 years or so when it looked like the US production was going to kind of fade away to nothing, and now the US is the biggest producer in the world. Maybe something like that could be achieved for natural hydrogen.
I think so. When I think of what the oil and gas industry does well, it's got this incredible sort of skill set around extracting molecules or drilling, moving molecules through pipes or ships or other ways, converting those molecules into other molecules, like chemicals are worth a lot, and doing anything offshore. And so those skill sets will translate into offshore wind or offshore solar or pipelines for CO2 or hydrogen or other types of chemical factories that start with a different molecule instead of starting with methane or naphthas or something starting with hydrogen to make whatever you need, but also drilling for heat, for geothermal, or drilling for hydrogen. So this is one of those elegant sort of labor justice, corporate smooth transition opportunities that can happen, because instead of drilling for one thing, you're still drilling, but you're drilling for something else. And there's a lot of expertise in drilling that'd be sad to throw away if we could put it to great use for society.
Well, and more than sad, I'll just bring it up to a high level. If we talk about the speed and scale that is required to do this energy transition, workforce constraints are a massive, massive consideration. So do we have the workforce we need to do all the different things we're talking about, whether it's installing a heat pump or digging a well for geothermal or something else? And so this is one of those things where you can do the cost optimized pathway and a model for what would take us to net zero given all the different technologies. But then who is going to do what and who has the skills where to do this? And if you can redeploy existing workforces to do things that are very, very closely related to what they know how to do really well, you will be able to move faster as opposed to having to retrain entire workforces. Now, there's still a big retraining thing, but I know in the work we do at the World Economic Forum that I'm involved in around the economics of equitable transition, that workforce training, deployment, redeployment conversation is a massive one. And to the point you just made, Michael, there are a few sides to this multi-sided coin. One is about what happens around equity and justice when it comes to historically fossil fuel communities, oil and gas communities, et cetera, who have had opportunities in the past, but you know they look very different as we're transitioning and you live through those boom and bust cycles and everything else. And then on the flip side, where are you providing opportunities or making sure that there are opportunities available for communities who haven't had that in the past as well? And so there's just a lot of facets to it, but it comes back to workforce. And it's a really important consideration in this. So speed and scale. This is massive stuff we're talking about with a transition.
So I just offered to put money down on nuclear fusion and when that is and is not going to be commercially viable. What do you both think about natural hydrogen? Are we seeing commercial natural hydrogen production by 2030, 2035, 2040? How close are we really to this actually being an industry?
I'm pushing it to Michael. Michael, go.
I'm not allowed to take this bet. Yeah,
with no money down.
Yeah, I've invested in a natural hydrogen company, so I've already made my bet. Okay. And I'm pretty enthusiastic about it. So I guess I can't make a bet with you because I've already made my own bet. But I think it, for a lot of reasons, has potential to be quite swift in many ways because it leverages what we already know how to do, which is look for molecules, drill for molecules, extract the molecules, then get them to market. And it reminds me potentially of the shale revolution, where we went from essentially zero shale oil and gas in 2008 to about $150 billion a year of oil and gas by 2019. So in 11 years, it went from zero to 150 billion because it leveraged existing know-how and existing sites and that kind of thing. So maybe natural hydrogen moves more slowly than shale, but we could imagine within a couple of decades, it's a pretty prominent thing, which means that we'll see some early commercial activity in the next couple of years.
Melissa, what do you think?
I would be very surprised if natural hydrogen didn't have an increasing role in this conversation. I'll say that. Like, back to the geographic conversation, there will be some places that have these resources, some that don't. I would imagine that Michael maybe can tell me if I'm wrong, that not every time we drill will we be successful or as successful as we might have wanted to be. And we're going to have a learning curve. And, you know, there's all types of learnings we can already bring into the system, but we're still going to have to learn as we go, which will include a few bruises along the way. But I think it just makes sense based on what we're seeing that it will play a significant role if the energy system keeps moving forward, how it is moving forward. Now, how big a role? There's a lot of factors in that. How big a role, where, when? There's a lot. But if we don't see a future where it has a much bigger role than it does today, I will be very surprised. So I guess I would put my bet on at least that part of the conversation. But that seems like betting on a sure thing, if I'm honest. So I don't know how risky it is. My odds are probably, for my returns, are probably not that good on that bet because it's so soft.
Yeah, I mean, given how much energy has surprised us in the past with so many completely unexpected developments and no doubt still has the potential to surprise us massively in the future, that does sound very sensible not to be trying to make the big world bets on it. Being cautious probably is the right way to go.
I will say one thing, though, that I was asked a few years ago by a prominent, very knowledgeable person in the energy sector, you know, what could change this equation, these set of results, this thing that we were looking at in terms of the mix of technologies that's needed. And I said, oh, if we can get hydrogen really cheap, like that will change this. I mean, that was the thing I checked out, the first response. And I still would say the same thing today. Like the balance of other technologies around firm power, around, you know, variable renewables, around different types of energy storage, short and long term. Like if we can figure out hydrogen and get it cheaply into the system, that is a game changer. That changes so much in my model that is about the theory of the future, but it also changes so much in terms of practical pathways forward. So this is no small deal, is what I will say.
Kind of going back to the hydrogen ladder, the successful places for hydrogen most likely are the places that are most difficult to electrify. Aviation, marine shipping, industrial heat, industrial chemicals, maybe heavy-duty trucking, maybe building heat in some other places. But for the most part, it's pretty limited because electricity is so cost-competitive and so efficient and has other performance benefits. But kind of come back to what Melissa said, but if you have a lot of clean, cheap hydrogen, it starts to take more spots in that hydrogen ladder because the performance differences with electricity might not be as obvious or the cost difference might not be as obvious. And so the numbers you said earlier, Ed, were like 500 million tons a year. Right now, we're like 60 to 100 million tons a year of hydrogen, depending on how you count. And so that goes up by a factor of 5 to 8, maybe a factor of 10. So maybe we can imagine a billion tons a year of hydrogen at some point. But if you have really cheap, abundant, clean hydrogen, you can start to imagine more than that because it just ends up being easier to burn it in existing engines than to expand the electrical infrastructure, for example. Because I think we need a lot more electrons, but it's also hard to double the grid in a decade or so. So we'll see. And this is like a multi sort of factor thing. And then a fusion, if that takes off, like we talked about earlier in the program, if fusion really works, well, then electricity outcompetes yet again. So we'll just kind of see. I don't think the markets have chosen their winner yet. And there's a lot of technical risk, business model risk, policy risk, and we'll just kind of see how it goes.
That's a great point. And again, something we've talked about quite a bit on the show before. It was true then, it's still true now, which is given all that uncertainty, we need to be making a number of different bets across a broad range of technologies. Because as you say, it's not clear what's going to ultimately win out, what mix of technologies will ultimately win out. And given that overarching imperative to reduce emissions, to address climate, to cut greenhouse gases in whatever way we can, we can't afford to just bet on one or two or a handful of different technologies. We have to borrow your analogy again, Michael, we have to use every tool in the toolbox. And as you say, some are probably going to turn out to work better than others. But at the moment, we don't really want to be in the position of ruling anything out simply because we can't be certain at this stage what eventually is going to work really effectively at scale and what isn't. Which is a good segue, I think, then into the final thing I want to talk about today, which is another of these technologies that Microsoft and Google and Nucor have been talking about, which is long-duration storage. Of course, there is a lot of short-duration storage now being deployed onto the grid. People are using lithium-ion batteries to back up variable renewables. But those are very strictly limited. They're typically used for managing power supply and demand within the day. Actually, increasingly, even within the hour, managing fine variations of power supply and demand on very short timescales, they're really not very good at all for dealing with variability over a period of many days or even weeks. To do that, you need some new technology for long-duration storage, which we don't really have at the moment. And one option for that that's now being talked about quite a bit and made quite a big jump forward this month is this idea of electrothermal storage, where basically people talk about hot rocks. Hot bricks probably is a bit more accurate as a way to describe it. You have these bricks and you heat them using electric heaters, which run intermittently when you have excess power being generated by your wind or your solar or whatever it might be. You heat these bricks up and they get hotter and hotter and hotter, and they can get up to temperatures of about 1500 degrees centigrade, and then they hold their heat remarkably well. And so that is where the energy is stored, essentially, as heat. And then you can release it, you can make steam, drive a turbine, turn it back into electricity again, or you can actually use it as industrial heat. And again, talking about hard to decarbonize sectors where hydrogen could be very useful is in industrial sectors that need very high temperatures that are hard to get at with electricity. You can use these hot bricks to deliver temperatures of 1000 degrees centigrade or more. So it could be very useful for many of these industrial processes. And so this is a pretty exciting storage technology, and it just took, as I say, a big jump forward this month. There's a California-based company called Rondo, which announced this month an agreement with EDP of Portugal to deploy what it calls these heat batteries to provide industrial heat for companies in a whole range of industries, in food and beverage, large chemical complexes, big factories, and so on. At a fairly large scale, they're talking about using 400 megawatts of wind and solar power to, as I say, provide the heat to heat up these batteries, and then can be deployed in a number of different locations to provide that heat. So theoretically, a very interesting and promising technology now does seem to be taking a real step forward towards commercialization. Melissa, what do you think about this thermal storage? Are you excited by it?
I think thermal storage is great, and it's one of those, what is it? We talk about energy efficiency as being the first fuel, but also the forgotten fuel. So I think about that actually similarly with long-duration energy storage and thermal storage. So when I was working at the IEA a dozen years ago and was setting up the energy storage work with the first energy storage technology roadmap they did, we did not just electricity storage and batteries, we did thermal storage. And it is so often cost competitive, makes a lot of sense. And when it comes to whether it's storing heat in bricks, stones, or really innovative, cool materials that can actually store high levels of heat that you can put into industry, like, these are exciting technologies that will provide us with a lot more flexibility in the system and fill a need. Because no offense to 4 hours, 8 hours, 12 hours, even 100 hours, we need more than that. And thermal storage can fill some of those seasonal gaps in some applications. But also, we need that high temperature heat. And so if we can do that cost effectively, that's really exciting. So I spent a bunch of time with some long-duration energy storage companies here in the United States about a year ago or so, just looking through the different technologies. And these are real things coming into the systems that can help us to reduce use of natural gas, which, if you're in Europe, but even if you're not, is a big consideration, but can do a lot of other things for us in the system. So I find it very, very interesting. Michael, what do you think, though?
Yeah, I think you're kind of backing up same kind of idea as with hydrogen. There are many ways to make hydrogen, and there are many ways to store energy. And we tend to get obsessed with lithium-ion batteries because that's what we're familiar with our smartphones and our laptop computers and now electric vehicles. Those batteries are getting cheaper and have high performance, and they have all sorts of benefits, but they have this short duration, as Melissa said. So we got to think about, what are the longer durations? Could be different battery chemistry, could be pumped hydroelectric, could be compressed air energy storage, could be phase change materials, and it could be thermal storage, storing heat or storing cold. At the University of Texas, we have huge tanks that store tens of millions of gallons of chilled water, basically ice water that we use for cooling. And that means we don't have to build another power plant because we can chill the water at night and then use it during the day for cooling the campus. Same kind of thing with heat. You use excess energy to heat your bricks or rocks or whatever it is, or your molten salt if it's a concentrating solar power plant, and then you release that heat over time as you need it. So I think it's pretty exciting. It's one more tool in the toolbox, coming back to what we said earlier, that has different performance envelope, pretty simple technology in terms of moving parts, that kind of thing. Bricks and rocks and stones are in abundance and have been known for many thousands of years, and you can plug it into your system, either for the electricity, as you said, or the heat. And a lot of customers actually just want the heat. Like the University of Texas in the end just wants the chilled water. A lot of industrial processes, hey, give us hot things, hot gases or whatever, we can use that. And so that works. Now, Rondo in particular, I'm fond of. We've invested in Rondo through Energy Impact Partners, which I serve as CTO. And so we know them well. And we think, yeah, this is one of the solutions that people are going to like in abundance.
Yeah, it is certainly a really interesting technology, definitely one that's going to be worth keeping an eye on. Now, we do, unfortunately, just about have to leave it there. Before we go, though, we, of course, have to do our free electrons, personal items that we have brought in. Michael, what's yours?
I was just at a big energy conference in Houston, and out in front, there was a Bentley and a McLaren. And so it just made me think the energy sector is doing well. And I just kind of cracked up about that. Professors drive Fords, but I think energy executives and entrepreneurs drive McLarens and Bentleys. And the thing that I think is fascinating right now from the American perspective is historically one form of energy puts another form of energy at risk. But right now we're seeing an abundance of growth in oil and gas production, record exports, record profits, and a growth in wind, and a growth in solar, and a growth in hydrogen, and a growth in carbon sequestration, and a growth in geothermal, and growth in battery. Like, we're having incredible growth. The only loser right now in the United States is coal, but they don't really show up to these energy conferences anyway, historically, at least not the ones I go to. And so it's kind of interesting time that looking at that Bentley 10 years ago, I said, okay, that's probably a shale billionaire. And now I'm like, well, it could be a wind billionaire. There's a lot of people making money right now. The energy sector is really robust in the United States, and that's a fascinating phenomenon to witness up close.
Yeah, absolutely. As you say, it's always striking when you see those very visible signs of wealth that makes you realize, as you say, just what a lot of money is being made. Melissa, what's yours?
Oh, I've got several. One I actually was thinking about as we were talking through. Don't worry, I won't do all of them, but I'm just going to go with the top. One I was thinking about when we were talking about all of the Google stuff, we were emphasizing data centers, but I was actually thinking about other things that are creating more demand for electricity. And I don't know if you were following the Biden administration's announcement on the rules that are aimed at expanding electric vehicles and just, you know, how do we get more EVs and hybrids into the system and how regulating tailpipe emissions will affect that. So I've been following that. Really interesting to watch, especially for someone like me who's studied for so many years many types of air pollution, greenhouse gas emissions being one of those types of air pollution. So particulate matter, nitrogen oxide, SOx, all that stuff, volatile organic compounds. Oh man, you want to get into some crazy air pollution chemistry, Ed? We can do that another day. Flashbacks to my PhD. But within each of these things, it's interesting looking at how these efforts to protect health in certain ways and to improve public health in certain ways actually has these co-impacts and co-benefits in most cases, not all cases, but a lot of cases on greenhouse gas emissions and climate goals. So I've just been following that. The second one I just wanted to mention real quick as a shout out, because Michael's here today, which is that I'm diving into his book, Powering Humanity, which I think I mentioned was one of the ones I grabbed at the beginning of the year. I got a copy when I was in Austin at the symposium that Michael's group puts on each year at University of Texas at Austin. And I started to read it, then, you know, things happened and I hadn't finished it. And now I'm diving even more into it. And it's a really good and interesting collection of writings. And one quote that I will just grab from it, because I've used it since I was a student at UT Austin, is talking about right at the beginning of the book, Nobel laureate Richard Smalley of Rice University, and basically a talk that he gave in 2003 highlighting the top 10 problems of humanity for the next 50 years, of which energy was number one. Anyway, enjoying the book. Michael, enjoying you adding to your collection of things you have authored and looking forward to reading through more of it. But that's the current one I'm feeding through, because I will sheepishly admit that I had a stack of books I was reading all simultaneously, and, you know, it kind of got passed around in the order, and now I'm back to it. So I'm reading through like the second half right now. So those are my two. I will stop there and not read the rest of my list.
Indeed. But it's very good then that you're able to come on the show and kind of unburden yourself to Michael in person about this issue. And now, as you say, bring the good news that you resolved it and you are actually getting
my guilt. I got guilt. I will say, listeners, tell me if I'm wrong. I think many of us suffer from this multiple books problem, especially when you're balancing different topics and genres. So I do have existential guilt, though. So there you go. I've unburdened myself at this point.
Indeed. I'm sure your sins are forgiven. So my free electron is something much less cheerful, I'm afraid, which is something, though, that I do think everyone should take a look at. It's really interesting. It's still kind of unclear at the moment. It's very much kind of emerging as an issue, but it's something I think everyone should be aware of and thinking about, which is the question of climate models and how far they're able to explain global warming. Now, this is from an article in the journal Nature by Gavin Schmidt, who is the director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York. And basically what he's writing about is how the Earth in 2023 was much warmer than climate models predicted. We've talked about this before, talked about this on the last show. In fact, we're going through a period of very striking global temperatures. What Gavin Schmidt says is if you look back at the past 9 months or so, I think, average global temperatures have been 0.2 degrees centigrade higher than the climate models would have suggested. And as these things go, that's a huge amount. As I'm sure everyone knows, climate models nowadays are really pretty good, particularly they're good in making these quite short-term predictions. So when you think sort of at the start of a year how the climate's going to turn out for that year, generally they have a pretty high degree of accuracy. Last year, though, they were off. They underestimated how much warming there would be very significantly. And Gavin Schmidt writes, he says, in general, the 2023 temperature anomaly has come out of the blue, revealing an unprecedented knowledge gap. And there's various explanations flying around for why the world might have been warmer. One of the big things that people talk about quite a bit is sulfur in shipping fuel. Sulfur was taken out of fuel used by ships in the past few years, and sulfur compounds in the atmosphere tend to reflect heat. So if you're getting less sulfur going to the atmosphere, then maybe that's allowing more heat to reach the Earth. That could be part of what's going on, but it also may not be large enough to explain the size of the overshoot in global temperatures. So it raises big questions about what's going on. Are there things happening in the climate that we don't really understand? What is there that's happening? One of the things that he says in this article is we'll probably get a sense fairly soon. Part of what's going on is the El Nino effect, of course, with a formation that tends to drive warmer years. By August of this year, that will have kind of dropped out of the system now, the models. So by August, temperatures ought to be falling back. If they aren't, then there is definitely something going on that is unexplained. So, as I say, it's kind of early days yet. We don't really know what's happening, but at the very least, it's something which is worth paying attention to. It's quite disturbing. It is something that may turn into a very serious issue in terms of the climate. So, as I say, worth a lot more investigation, worth keeping a close eye on for everybody involved in energy, climate politics, everything to do with that. It's something I think that we all need to be aware of.
No, I think it's a really important point, Ed. And I think it highlights something that's come up a few different times in conversations over the last year, which is that things we thought wouldn't happen until 1.5 degrees of global temperature change, average temperature range, is happening sooner. So it's happening, you know, several fractions of degrees sooner. And so the question is, where are the different tipping points that we may have thought were further out that are actually closer in? And what does that do in terms of what we do on mitigation and the speed at which we go towards mitigation, but also adaptation? Because the climate is already changing, damage is happening, our health is already being affected. So how are we adapting? And it is not, I will say, a uplifting conversation, as you said, Ed. This is pretty serious stuff. It's practical to me. It's like, hey, our models can tell us these things. It can't tell us these things. What do we do in the face of that uncertainty? What do we know for sure? What could we potentially be underestimating? And, you know, how do we respond from a policy perspective? It's a really important conversation to have. And I appreciate when it comes to the Nature article, you know, what was the headline? Climate models can't explain 2023's huge heat anomaly. We could be in uncharted territory. It's also couching there. Like, we could be in some uncharted territory. The point is, we don't know exactly what is happening there. And we need to figure it out so that we can then respond. And I'm grateful to all the scientists who spend their careers diving into that information, because it's really important and directly affects, you know, our lives. So appreciate you bringing it up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, as you say, that's a great way to think about it. Sorry to be ending the show on a downbeat note, but as you say, it's practical. It's something that everybody does need to be thinking about. It could have extremely serious practical consequences, and it's important that we understand that as deeply as we possibly can.
And it double clicks on the conversations around adaptation and the need to invest in it. So when we look at our climate policies and we're emphasizing mitigation, which we need to do, but also there's this adaptation piece, especially in the most vulnerable communities. Again, practical pathways forward and practical conversation, what needs to be done in the near term, and especially if the near term is even sooner than we thought. So again, very important. Great to bring it up.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, we do then have to leave it there. Thanks very much indeed, Melissa, for joining us.
Yeah, enjoyed the conversation. Good to be on here with y'all to talk through these topics.
Absolutely. Thanks very much to you, Michael.
Thanks for having me. I always enjoy the conversation.
Great to see you. Hope to have you back again soon. Thanks to our producers, Sam Nash and Toby Biggins-Gilchrist. And above all, many thanks to all of you for listening. As you know, we really value your feedback, so please do keep it coming. And we'll be back in 2 weeks with all the latest news and views on the energy transition. Until then, goodbye.